Well, James was a pastor with a pastoral heart for the recipients of his letter. And for the opening 16 verses of chapter 1, he has been referring to trials and temptations. Consider it joy when you face trials of many kinds. The testing of your faith will develop perseverance. And perseverance must finish its work so that you become mature and not lacking anything. James shows that trials are inevitable, whatever your station in life. If you're poor, that's a trial. And if you're rich, that's a trial. Life is trial, temptation, followed by trial and temptation. And up to this point in his letter, you might be thinking, well, James is essentially saying that life stinks. Trials, temptations, and then death. And if you're a pastor, or if you're a counsellor, or if you're a doctor, you deal with people. And people are always coming and talking about their situations, and you get to see what life is really like. And after a while, you realise that life stinks. Because even if life isn't going too badly for you, you see how many other people are falling into all kinds of trials and troubles that are inevitable in life. And you really see that life is difficult. You know the old proverb that says, the same sunlight that melts wax hardens clay. And what that means is that sunlight comes down upon all people. The difficulties of life come down on some people and they just seem to make them softer and wiser and more tender. But the same troubles come down on other people and it seems to make them broken and bitter and brittle. You witness people going through the trials of life and they get better, and you see other people going through the same troubles of life and they get worse. And James is telling us in this opening chapter that we have to deal with the trials that come upon us properly. We have to meet them with a discipline, we have to meet them with faith, we have to meet them with self-control. Now, it's inevitable that as a pastor, James would have heard something like this from his parishioners. Yes, we understand that trials are inevitable. We realise that we need to consider the things that you've been telling us. But where do we get the strength from? Where do we get the resources from? You know, I think the average person says that when troubles come along, I want to be strong. I want to be able to face them. I don't want to just fall apart. I don't want to just run around and lose it. But where do we get the strength and the resources from for that? Well, that's what James is telling us in the passage that we're focusing on today. Turn over to James chapter 1. You see, we can't just crank this up ourselves. We can't just draw on our inner resources. We desperately need something to help us to face the trials and temptations of life. And what James is showing us is that there is a motivation that we can have through Christianity, and there is a power that we can have through Christianity. James 1 and verse 17. Every good gift, every perfect gift, is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. This is the motivation that we can have that will enable us to deal with the difficulties of life. Verse 18, he chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we may be a kind of first fruits of all he created. This is the new power that will enable us to deal with our difficulties in life. And so that's what we're looking at today, the motivation and the power for dealing with whatever life throws at us. So first of all, the motivation. James tells us in verse 17 that we as Christians are not just to enjoy every good and perfect gift, but we are to see what is behind it. Now, C.S. Lewis makes the same case that James makes here in a sermon that's entitled The Weight of Glory. And he also makes the same argument in a chapter in his book Mere Christianity. The chapter's entitled Hope. This is his point. He says that when you get into the presence of the good gifts of life, you may be listening to a great piece of music. You might be standing on the seashore with a beautiful landscape in front of you. You may be in front of a person that you are falling in love with. And sometimes you get overtaken with a very palpable sense that you're in the presence of something that you've wanted all of your life. If you have these good gifts, the beautiful face, the beautiful landscape, the beautiful piece of music, you'll finally be happy. And Lewis says, when that happens, we say, well look, marry him or her. Build a house there where that beautiful view is. At least go and buy that piece of music that you like so much. And when that happens, you go after this good gift, and then you finally say, I've got it. But you'll discover what Lewis says. You marry the person, you build the house, you take the CD home with you, but you'll always find that the vision fades. And that's because what Lewis is saying, what James is saying here is that these things are not really the bearers of light. They're not the sun, they're the moon. And the moon is always shifting. The moon is always changing its light because it has no light within itself. It's just reflecting the light of something else. And as a result, one night the moon may be really bright enough for you to read by, but on other nights it won't be because it doesn't have light in itself. And in the same way, the music, the romance, the seashore, these are all good, but they actually don't have within them the thing that we sense through them. The light is not the music, it's not the romance, it's not the seashore. These things only point to something that we so desperately need. Now, in his sermon, The Weight of Glory, Lewis says this. When you stand before the object, the good gift, when you stand before the beautiful woman, when you stand before the seashore, or you listen to that piece of music, after the vision dies and the landscape loses its celestial beauty and the music ends, you suddenly realize that beauty has smiled upon you, but it has not welcomed you. We have not really been accepted, we've not been welcomed or taken into the dance. It was not the physical objects that we were after, but that indescribable something of which they for a moment have been just the mere messengers. And he goes on to say that our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe has been, filled that we've been cut off from. To be on the inside of some door that we've always been on the outside of. It's no mere neurotic fantasy. But it's the truest index of our real situation. We are to shine as the sun. And so Lewis says, we don't merely want to see beauty. We want something that we can hardly put into words. We want to be united with the beauty we see. We want to pass into it. We want to receive it into ourselves. And we want to bathe in it. We want it to become a part of us. But he says, that's the promise of the gospel, that one day God will give us the splendor of the sun. And he says the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that someday, God willing, we will put on the glory of nature, or rather the greater glory of what nature is only the first sketch. Now what Lewis is saying and what James is telling us here is that when you get a good gift, you have to see what's behind it. That's the critical thing. And what's behind it is the Father of lights. The perfect light. It's the ultimate light. It's the unchanging light. It's the unshifting light. It's the sun and not the moon. Now, if you understand that, you will endure anything. You see, what James is saying here is very, very practical. How do you deal with a life that stinks? How do you deal with the difficulties of life? Well, here it is. Every good and perfect gift is from above. Now, do you know what that means? It means when you get all of your friends together and you have a great meal sitting around a fire, that's from God. An incredible piece of music is from God. See, it doesn't matter whether Mozart or Beethoven were horrible people. Their music is a gift from God. You see, a great singer is singing with the voice of God. A great meal, a great friendship, a wonderful seashore scene, a terrific piece of music. They're good gifts and they're all from God, every single one of them. You see, this is the doctrine of common grace. You see, we just need to think how merciful God is. He throws out into this enormous world a great deal of common sense and wisdom and talent and beauty, and he gives it to people. He gives it to communities regardless of whether they believe in him or not, regardless of whether they're Christians or not. You see, a Christian doesn't say, well, look, he's not a Christian composer. This isn't Christian music. These aren't Christian people. How could I possibly enjoy that? No, not at all, you see. James is saying every good and perfect gift is from above. So enjoy them. They are gifts from God. Appreciate God. Praise God as you're enjoying these gifts. Enjoy it, but don't mistake it for the reality to which they point, or you will be continually disappointed. You see that? Samuel Rutherford was an old Scottish preacher, but he had a great way of putting it. It's a little bit of an old English, but this is what Rutherford said. Our little inch of time suffering is not worthy of our first night's welcome home to heaven. When once Christ shall thrust your weary traveller's head onto his breast, you will find that just the first one of his kisses will pay for 500 years of sore hearts. Oh, my friends, don't sell all of this for Esau's morning breakfast. And of course we remember Esau's morning breakfast, don't we? Esau had the birthright. He was the oldest. He had the inheritance. And one day he comes home and he's so hungry, and Jacob, his younger brother, has been there cooking up this great stew, and Esau comes in and says, oh, look, give me some of that. I'm so hungry. And Jacob says, why should I? I mean, I've done all the work. I've cooked it. I've prepared for it. And he says, I'll do anything. I'll do anything for some of that stew. And Jacob says, well, okay, give me the birthright then. And he says, well, okay. I'm starving to get it. What good is having an inheritance somewhere off in the distance if I'm going to starve to death now? And so for morning breakfast, he gives up his inheritance. And, you know, we look at that story, we read it, we hear it, and we say, well, that's incredible. What an idiot. Who would put all of his money into something like that? Who would do such a thing? And, you know, the answer is, well, actually, you and me would do the same thing. Because we marry the man or woman of our dreams, we build the house on the seashore, the house that we've always wanted, or we take home that CD of magnificent music, and you know, when our spouse doesn't turn out to really make us happy, or the new house becomes old and lived in, and the music just fades away, when life doesn't turn out exactly the way that we expected it or hoped it to be, we turn around and we say, life stinks! And so what is James saying to us here? He's saying, well, look, they are all good gifts, all of them. But only if you see them as gifts. They're shifting. They're changing. They are moons, not suns. If you see them for what they are, you'll be able to enjoy them. If you don't, and you put too much store in them, you will end up becoming a bitter person. So what should we do? Well, we have to look behind and beyond the gift. What is it, the gift that mankind really needs? What is the permanent gift from the one who does not change like the shifting shadows? What is that gift that he can give us that is really going to satisfy us? Well, look back in verse 12. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, Because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. Now what does that mean? Well, in the context of what James is saying here, it means enjoy the good gifts, but don't dare sell the wedding supper of the Lamb for Esau's morning breakfast. Don't sell the kisses of Jesus for the kisses of anyone else. See, all human beings have to answer a question that they're inevitably confronted with. And that is there a creator God? Is there? If not, life is meaningless. You know, we're all just protoplasm. Trials, temptation, and then death. And life stinks. But if there is a God, it means only what is done for him will last. And you see, it's one or the other. There's no in between. Either your life is meaningless and nothing makes any difference at all, or else the wedding supper of the Lamb and the crown of life mean everything. But unfortunately, there are people right now like Esau. They say, well, you know, I believe there is a God, and he has said what I should do and what I shouldn't do, but actually, I'd rather have the kisses of someone else right now. I'm so hungry. What good is my birthright? What good is the marriage supper of the Lamb in the future if I don't have some stew right now? You see, don't sell the wedding supper of the Lamb for Esau's morning breakfast. Don't sell the crown of life. Now what does it mean to take all of that on? Well, as Christians, we are to fill our minds with the crown of life and with the wedding supper of the Lamb. If we believe there is a God, and we are faithful to him, and we give ourselves to him, then that's what you're in for. That's what your future is. The crown of life and the wedding supper of the Lamb. You see, that is our motivation. We are to reflect and we are to ponder on this future, and we are to say, that's what I'm after. That's where I'm heading. That is what my future is. And with that future promised to me, I can face whatever comes to me in this life. You see, that is our motivation. Don't sell his kisses. One kiss from the Lord Jesus will wipe out 500 years of sore hearts. Now that's either true or it's not. And if it's not true, and if there is no God, and if there is really no Jesus, then we have nothing to live for. It's all arbitrary. Right and wrong, that's just a matter of your opinion or my opinion. There's nothing worth dying for. There's nothing to be heroic for. On the other hand, if there is a God, and we can know him through Jesus, and we can be at the wedding supper of the Lamb and receive that crown of life, then there is nothing, nothing that is worth losing all of that for. It means we can endure anything. We can even die if necessary, because we know that that future is assured. Now do you see? That's the motivation for the Christian life. We enjoy life. We enjoy all of the good gifts that God has given to us. But we know what's on the way. And that's the reason why Lewis was able to say the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumour that someday, God willing, we will be there. We will put on the glory. We will put on the perfect heavenly light. The greater glory, that Lewis says, which nature is only the first sketch. So that's our motivation. We have a whole new approach to life because we're looking beyond the physical things that happen. The things that can just shift and change. And we're looking to what is permanent. The crown of life and the wedding supper of the Lamb. But you know, there's something else that is needed to help us to face the trials and temptations of life. And this is our second point. The power for dealing with what life throws at us. Verse 18. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we may be a kind of first fruits of all he created. So, in addition, James is saying, look, you need the right motivation, but there's another thing that you need to have, and that is you need to be born again. We need to be born of the Spirit, and we need to have the power that he brings. You see, in a sense, this is the ultimate good gift that God gives us. Of course, there are people that say, well, born again Christians, it's just a part of Christianity. But you know, that's not what the New Testament says. Here James says God gives us birth. Not just a few, not just a branch of Christianity, not just a select group of Christians. All Christians are born from above, are born again. In fact, you're not a Christian if you're not born again. You're not a Christian if you've not had this new birth. Born again is an absolute necessity. You know, as Jesus said to Nicodemus, you must be born again. You must. There's no choice. Now, there are always people that will say, well, this born again business is some sort of religious cathartic experience. And while they say, well, that's all very well, but what we really need is to live by Christian ethics. And they will argue that it's not so much what you believe about Jesus or whether you've had this kind of mystical experience. What's really important is that you follow his teachings, like the Sermon on the Mount, you know, turn the other cheek, blessed are the peacemakers, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's the important thing, that you live a good life. But you know, I'm afraid it's very naive to say that. Because anybody who really reads the Sermon on the Mount and understands what Jesus is saying there, and anybody who has any knowledge about themselves, will realize that being meek and being merciful and thirsting and hungering for righteousness and being pure in heart and all of the other things, well, then you'll realize that unless you have been born again, you couldn't possibly do any of those things. Anybody who says you don't have to be born again, just live like the Sermon on the Mount, just live a good Christian life, doesn't understand the Sermon on the Mount, and doesn't understand what it is to live a Christian life. We couldn't possibly live like that unless something comes into us and changes us utterly and amazingly. So the first thing that we learn here is that there is an absolute necessity for a kind of outside intervention, a power from outside coming into us. But the second thing that we learn here is that this power that comes is a humbling thing. To become a Christian is to be born spiritually. Now, I don't know if you've seen many people be physically born. I've seen two people be born, my two children. Some of you may have seen more births, and some of you may not have seen any. But here's one thing that I remember from the birth of my two children. They were very immature when they were born. I couldn't say to either of them, okay, well, look, now you've arrived, that's good. Go and get dressed, and we'll make our way home. Say that to them. Because they're babies. They're utterly helpless. And the concept of spiritual birth is telling us that if you want the power to deal with these things in your life, you have to start at the bottom. It doesn't matter how many PhDs you've got or where you got your honours degree from. It doesn't matter what status you've got in your job. It doesn't matter how intelligent you are in any field at all. To become a Christian means you start at the bottom. You start like a babe in arms. You come into the spiritual world and you receive this new life, and then you have to say, well, what do I do next? You see, you start with baby steps, and it takes a terrific amount of humility. You see, just the idea of being born again, just the metaphor is a way of saying, well, look, you want this power. You see that you need this power in your life. And you have to start at the very bottom. Now, James tells us here that we are born again through the word of truth. The spirit of truth mediates the word of truth into us so that we have the power to live by the truth and do the right thing. We go by the truth, but the truth becomes something that is alive in us. And the truth is not a set of rules. It's not just a list of do's and don'ts. The truth comes inside us. It becomes a part of us. It becomes alive. It becomes real. It becomes you. Just think about vegetable life and animal life and human life. Each of them is a kind of life. But if a human being goes back to the animal level, we feel like the person has died. And if an animal goes back to the vegetable level, you feel like the animal is dead. Now, what differentiates vegetable from animal from human? Because they're all forms of biological life. Why do we see them at different levels? Well, it's to do with the area of sensation. Plants can sense their environment. They're aware of certain things, but they don't have five senses. You know, they can sort of sense heat and light and touch and so on. But animals are more aware of their environment. They have senses. They can touch and they can taste and see and hear and smell. But you know, they can't sense everything in their environment. They can't sense the difference between justice and tragedy. They can't sense the difference between ugliness and beauty. They can't sense the difference between right and wrong. Now, as human beings, normally those things are there. You know, when we see someone being cruel or being oppressive or someone being violent, we can look at that and say, that's wrong. Now, animals can't see that. So in other words, every higher level of sensation moves you on to a higher level of life. Now, spiritual life is something you're ushered into when you're born again. And let me say that we will never deal with our troubles unless we've been ushered into it. Now, what is it? What happens when you are born from above? Well, it doesn't mean that you get smarter. It doesn't mean that your IQ goes up. Notch or two when you're born again. What it means is that the things that were either theoretical to you or either were just nonsense, they become solid. So, the love of God, the generosity of God, the mercy of God, the faithfulness of God, and the crown of life. All of the things that James has been talking about in the early part of this chapter, they all become real. They all become a part of us. You see, when you read what James is saying here, mentioning these things, how do you respond? You think, well, this is all stupid. All I'm experiencing is trials and temptation. And then I'll die. And life stinks. Or did anything stir in you as you read these words? Did you start to say, I know that this is what my God is like. The Father of heavenly lights who doesn't change like the shifting shadows. The crown of life and the marriage supper of the Lamb is all that I want. You see, the way that you know that you've been born again is that you've entered into a new realm of the things that used to be nonsense to you, or the things that were just theoretical, become real. They begin to profoundly affect you. And like Job, you'll be able to say, my ears have heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. See, that's the difference. And we will never ever deal with the difficulties of life unless the truth of God is no longer just an intellectual thing, but it has come into our hearts and has become a part of us. It's become real and it's become solid. You see, when you're born again, it's not that you become more intelligent. Rather, you see solid things that were just theoretical before. And now they console you in your difficulties. They enable you to be able to deal with your trials. And they move you on to the crown of life. I don't know if you've ever read Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. But there's a place in the book where Jane is being tempted. There's a man who's already married. His wife is alive, but she's physically incapacitated. And Jane has started to develop a relationship with this man. And the man says to her, come and be with me. Come and be with me. Come and be my wife. Now, how does she deal with that temptation? Well, this is what she says. While he spoke, my very conscience and reason turned traitors against me and charged me with the crime of resisting him. They spoke as loud as feeling and they clamoured wildly. Oh, comply, it said. Think of his misery. Soothe him. Save him. Love him. Tell him you love him and will be his. And who in the world will care? Or who will be injured by what you do? And as she thought about it, this was the reply she gave herself. I care for myself. The more unstained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God. I will hold to the principles I received by me when I was sane and not mad as I am now. Laws and principles are not for times when there is no temptation. They are for moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against their rigour, stringent as they are, inviolate they shall be. If at my individual convenience I might break them, what would be their worth? They have a worth, so I have always believed. And if I cannot believe it now, it is because I am insane, quite insane. With my veins running fire and my heart beating faster than I can count its throbs. Preconceived opinions, foregone determinations are all I have at this hour to stand by. But there, I plant my foot. I did. Now, I don't know if Charlotte Bronte was a Christian. I don't know if Jane Eyre was being depicted as a Christian, but I do know that when the truth of God is more than just a theory and it becomes real, when the truth is alive and it's been born in you, then you are able to say when your veins are running with fire, I respect myself only when I stand on these things. And here I plant my foot. And I did. The truth of Jesus Christ died for us so that we could be with God forever. That he paid the penalty for our sins so that we could be forgiven and reconciled with God. That he wore a crown of thorns so that we could wear the crown of life. I know that when that truth becomes real to you, that it's alive in you, it will be both a motivation and it will be a living power in your life that will enable you to cope with whatever life throws at you. With Jesus, we'll find that life doesn't stink. There is strength for the present, and there is great hope for the future. So allow the Holy Spirit to make the word of truth real to you. And don't be tempted to sell everything for Esau's morning breakfast. Rather, plant your foot on the truth of Christ, knowing that just one kiss from Jesus will deal with 500 years of sore hearts. It will all be dealt with as we sit at the marriage supper of the Lamb and we are crowned with his glory forever. May God speed that day.